owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. I've always had the greatest amount of respect for those persons who go into combat carrying a camera rather than a rifle. We'd have a number of them on the show. Best-selling author Sebastian Junger is a good example, and Air Force combat photographer Stacy Pearsall, who I remember telling me once, she said, you know, if things got bad enough where I needed a rifle by then, there'd be plenty of them laying around that I could use. These brave souls record history in real time, and that millisecond it takes the shutter on a camera to open and close, they've created iconic images that frame our perspective of war. I bet you've seen some of them. Robert Capa's The Falling Soldier, which is that image during the Spanish Civil War, right when a soldier is being hit, his rifle falling from his grasp as he falls backwards onto the ground. Of course, Joe Rosenthal's famous photo of the Marines raising the flag on Mount Suribachi during the Second World War on Iwo Jima. And then Nick Ut's photo of those terrified Vietnamese children running down the highway after a napalm attack, including 9-year-old Kim Phuc, her clothes completely burned off. There's another photo, actually a series of photos, captured by Reuters photographer Goran Tomcevic, taken in the Helmand province of Afghanistan. It captures the seconds when a Marine narrowly avoided death from a sniper's bullet. To this day, it portrays a sacrifice made every day by the heroes in what would be our nation's longest war. The photo itself is quite a story, and the story behind the photo is quite a story, and you're going to hear that today. But it's just an introduction to a much larger story of the sacrifices that our men and women of the military make, sometimes fighting the enemy on the battlefield, sometimes fighting the bureaucracy back home, and often fighting the ghosts that haunt them in their own heads. The Marine that was the subject of that iconic photograph is Bill B., and he joins us today. Bill, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
I appreciate you having me on.
Now, Bill, your story is told in a book, just recently published book, just hit the bookshelves, called The Shot, The Harrowing Journey of a Marine in the War on Terror, written by you and Wills Robinson. It's a great read. I just finished it up myself. Folks can learn more, visit SergeantBillB.com. Bill, you always wanted to serve in the military. I mean, your family tradition goes back to what, 1619?
Yeah, basically. We've got guys that fought in Massachusetts during the Revolutionary War, all the way up to, you know, my cousins who fought in enduring freedom as well.
So you were a kid out there running around in the woods playing bang bang with sticks and stuff, but I got to tell you, in your book, the first thing that struck me, the story of how you ended up choosing to be a Marine to become a devil dog is kind of a funny one. Relate that to our listeners, if you would.
Well, I mean, it was I knew I was going to go into one branch, wasn't sure which one. I tested real high on the ASVAB, so, you know, I had the Air Force talking to me about electronic warfare stuff. I had their Navy talking to me about wanting to work on nukes and subs and stuff. And the Army brought up the Spec Ops guys, which I kind of like the idea of that. But initially, I was all about the band. Like, that is literally what I originally enlisted for.
Now, musical band.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. The Marine Corps actually got like one of the most amazing bands out there when it comes to the branches, because they got the President's Own Drum and Bugle Corps, and I was a big time band geek. I was all over that. And
fair enough, I was in the marching band. No shame in that.
Oh yeah, yeah. And right before I graduated high school, it kind of changed my mind and just decided, you know, hey, if I'm going to do this, then I might as well go all the way. So went to the recruiter's office, and I told him I wanted to change my job to the infantry. And he tried talking me out of it. I mean, he did his best. My dad he offered to give me a car if I'd pick anything other than the infantry, you know. And it's a case that, no, this is really what I want to do. I want to shoot things. I want to blow stuff up.
And, that's something, I guess the funny thing about the story was, because later on in your Marine career, Bill, you were a recruiter. But that salty old Marine recruiter, he's in there doing pull-ups without breaking a sweat. And he's describing all the ways why you don't want to be a Marine, where, you know, you're going to have a, how does it go, something, you're going to have, you know, water, you're going to be so cold you have to keep a bottle of water next to your cheek to keep it from freezing, and then you'll be someplace so hot the water's just going to evaporate in the bottle, but you signed up anyway.
Yeah, I mean, as twisted as my mind was, I thought that'd be a great idea. It just sounded like an absolute blast.
So you joined at 17. You were in boot camp right out of high school. And let's fast forward a little bit. On September 11, 2001, you and your fellow Marines were in the barracks when you first got the news.
Yes, sir. We were actually we were on pre-deployment leave. We knew that we were going to go deploy to the Mediterranean Sea as part of a Marine Expeditionary Unit. And we were all set. We were actually on pre-deployment leave where half the unit was gone on vacation before we left, you know, because we're going 6-7 months at a time. And I just happened to be part of the unit that was still in the rear and came back from PT that morning, getting showered up, changed over. And, you know, that's when the first plane hit. And we were listening to a comedy show, actually, and we thought it was just somebody messing around. And, you know, one of my boys came running in, and he's like, hey, bud, you might want to turn on the TV. And when we did, that was right as the second plane hit. And that's pretty much when we knew some stuff was going down, you know.
And what immediately is... Was I reading your book, folks were scrambling to get off base? Because did the base go immediately into lockdown? Or,
I mean, oh, yeah, like the case of we knew we were under attack, especially when the plane went tagged the Pentagon. And it was a case of our platoon sergeant running down to the area where we're at. And he's like, look, you got 15 minutes to get off base because we're about to lock this place down. No one on, no one off. And, yeah. Anybody who lived off base, we hauled butt to our cars and just we moved at Mop Jesus trying to get out of that base before they shut it down.
Your first mission, you completed your first mission while rescuers literally, Bill, were still removing the rubble and looking for survivors at the World Trade Center towers. Tell us about that initial boarding mission with the Navy SEALs.
Well, that one happened... I want to say it was more along lines of October, November time frame. We had pulled out of a operation with the Egyptians. We call them dog and pony shows, you know, just showing off what the Marines can do. And in the middle of that operation, they pulled our battalion out of there and started transitioning us through the Suez Canal into the Arabian Sea. And the boat we were on, I was part of what's called a boat company. We work with Zodiacs and stuff like that. And my job principally was I was a radio operator and a scout swimmer. And we got word that one of Bin Laden's kids was supposedly on this Chinese merchant vessel. And we got pretty excited about that. We were really stoked. But it was kind of it was an eye-opener because, I mean, for the first time, you're being issued live rounds. And you're told, hey, you know, if this kid's here, he's not alone. I say kid, but I mean, I think deep within his 20s. But, like, you know, if he's here, he's not alone. So my first real world op was, we called it a vessel boarding search and seizure, where we fast roped out of a helicopter at night onto the deck of a moving ship, and we took it over trying to find this guy. We probably spent 8 hours on that boat if we didn't find anything but rice.
Well, part of me, as a civilian, I don't want to say that's a relief, but as a Marine, you're probably a little bit disappointed.
Yeah, it was a little bit of both. You know, we're excited because, hey, we actually got our first op under our belt. Nobody got hurt. Nobody got hit. But at the same time, you're like, you know, it would have been fun to do something and actually pull the trigger because that's what we've been training our entire career for.
Bill, how many combat deployments did you have?
I did 4 combat deployments to Afghanistan, and then I did 1 to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
Oh, boy. Okay, well, I tell you what, when we come back, I'd like to talk about something else that popped out in your book. It was an assignment that you asked for and took and turned out to be your least favorite, but it turned out to be a good thing in your life. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Ben Bueller-Garcia. We're talking with Bill B. The book is The Shot. Look it up. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. We're talking to Marine Bill B. His story can be found or find out more about Bill. Visit SergeantBillB.com, B-E-E. Bill, I really enjoyed your book. Honestly, I struggled a little bit with it because it was there's some very sobering facts in there that have nothing to do with combat itself, but rather the repercussions and what happens after combat to our brave men and women. I want to talk about that a little bit later. But one part that did make me smile, you had the opportunity to become a recruiter, and you thought that was going to be a pretty sweet deal, you know, wandering malls looking for young people you could sign up. But it turns out that was maybe some of your least favorite duty.
I volunteered for recruiting duty, which is not something that usually happens. But the recruiters, a lot of times, they get voluntold that that's what they're going to do. And the reason I chose it was by that time, by the end of my first enlistment, my first 4 years, I had already done 2 deployments to Afghanistan and 1 to Cuba. And I wanted the break. I wanted to be able to, you know, come home every night and stay home every night. So I had the bright idea of going on volunteering to be a recruiter. And my first sergeant tried to talk me out of it, tried to tell me, you know, you got Marine security guards, you got drill instructor. But no, I want to be a recruiter. I think that'd be a good time. And man, that was probably the roughest 3 years of my life.
Now, Bill, I learned something from this book. Of course, I'm a civilian, so there's no reason I would know, but the requirements on the recruiters are pretty tough. I mean, I can't remember the numbers exactly, but you need to sign up 3 recruits every day or don't go home. I mean, you're out there, hitting bars at 1 in the morning trying to sign people up just so you can get your quota?
Oh, yeah. It depends on your area, but like the area I was in, Johnstown, PA, it's also where the Shanksville area where Flight 93 went down. That was all part of my area. But we had to recruit 2.5 a month, and it's all about the numbers game. And that's one of the things that I really didn't like about the duty was it had nothing to do with how much effort you put into the job. Like some days or some months you could have 3 guys walk in and you're set for the month. And, you know, other days you could work or other months you could work 12-hour days all month and only get 1 guy in, you know.
I don't want to think about what that half a recruit looks like. Maybe that'd be a guy like me. So, and this is not just having them sign on the dotted line, but they've actually got a process and go through and show up, right? But before you get credit for it.
And a lot of people don't realize, like, the moral requirements for the Marine Corps are some of the highest compared to any of the branches. I've had guys come in all the time and we just weren't allowed to take them. And it could be, you know, some kind of charge they had before they were 18. It could be, you know, they didn't score high enough on a test, or it could be a simple medical issue, but there's a lot of guys we had to turn down. And it was crazy because when I was out there, the 04 to 07 timeframe, we were going pretty hard in Iraq and Afghanistan both. So we were definitely hurting for bodies. And, you know, the Army was able to drop their standards. They have a lot of bonuses that they could throw out, but the Marine Corps doesn't have the finances for that. So you get guys going from office to office. The Air Force told me they'd do this. The Army told me they'd give me $50,000. You know, what do you guys give me?
Pride.
Become a Marine. We will physically patrol you for 13 weeks. How about that?
I tell you, how old were you at the time?
When I was a recruiter, 22.
Okay. Tell us about the upside, the silver lining on all this. Bill, tell us about your most successful recruit, someone named Bobby.
Yeah. The one thing about me is I'm a severely introverted person, you know, and I'm a pretty shy guy. And the recruiter school kind of beats that out of you. You know, you're constantly up there giving speeches and all that stuff. So it doesn't work just on talking people into the military. Like I could sell a you know, ketchup popsicle to a woman in white gloves kind of thing. And when I showed up at the mall in Johnstown where I was going to work, my NCYC, my staff sergeant that was in charge of me, told me, you know, hey, man, you got 30 minutes. I want you to go around to introduce yourself to every single person that works in this mall. And all right, that's not a problem. And that's what I do, literally running store to store. Hey, how you doing? I'm Corporal B. I'm the new recruiter in the mall. All right, nice to meet you. Got to go kind of thing. And I walked into this jewelry store, and there's a woman there. She was way outside my league. Let's put it that way. And, you know, I walked up. Hey, how you doing? I'm Corporal B. I'm the new recruiter. So, okay, yeah, whatever. There were a few more choice words thrown in there, walked out, and basically love at first sight.
For you?
Yeah.
Well, long story short, you finally ended up winning her heart, and she's been with you ever since, and she's been, just from what I could tell in your book, she's been such a crucial part of your survival throughout this whole mess.
Absolutely. Like, I honestly probably, in fact, I know I wouldn't be alive and kicking if it wasn't for her. And I call her, I mean, she's basically like a care bear on caffeine, you know. And all the stuff that I've put my family through, she has always been having my back, and it's mind-blowing.
Bill, let's talk about the shot itself. You did not have much patience. You know, I talked at the beginning of the show how much I love journalists, combat journalists, but you didn't have much use for them until you... So Goran, the fellow that shot this famous series of images, he was clearly seasoned. I mean, he'd covered a lot of war. And he started off on the right foot when he embedded with your unit with, what was it, a carton of Marlboros?
Yep, exactly. Yeah, we kind of have a mixed experience with embeds, is what we called an embedded journalist. We had one from the beginning of that op that came with us. He did the helo insert with us and all that stuff. He made it one day, and we had to call a special evac for him to come out just so he can go back to the rear because he couldn't hang with us. And that kind of sours your impression. Like, the first time you have one and he beats speed after less than 24 hours, you're like, you know, oh, great. You know, these guys are more liability than anything. But when we got told to go pick up Goran from our company headquarters, I show up just expecting the same thing, and this guy pulls out cartons upon cartons of stateside Marlboro Reds. And man, if there's any way to get the squad of Marines to love you after, you know, 3 weeks of not getting mail, a carton of cigarettes will do it.
Was there anything else that struck you about him? I've heard, so Sebastian Junger, who I don't know if you've heard of him, but he also produced the documentary Restrepo. I've had other special operators that said he looks and carries himself like an operator. He's got that look. And you know, just looking at this guy, that he's going to be with you no matter what. Did you get that same impression with Goran initially, or?
A little, yeah. Well, it was a combination of two things. It was, he's got that operator mentality of, I am not going to get hurt in any way, shape, or form. You know, this is the kind of environment he thrives in. And then there's also just a little touch of insanity there, which I think you've got to have if you're going to be running around someplace like Helmand Province with a camera. And the guy is just goofy as all get out. I love him to death.
Did he ever get the Pulitzer for this shot?
I'm not sure on that one. I know he had received a Pulitzer later on. I don't know what it was for, though.
Okay. Well, when we come back, I'd like to talk more about this, because, folks, I encourage you just to go on the Internet or go to Bill's website, and you can see this series of four or five photos that are just incredibly compelling and brought him to the place where he is now. We're talking about him here on American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We'll be back with more with Bill B. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Marine Bill B. His incredible journey is told in a book called The Shot, The Harrowing Journey of a Marine in the War on Terror, co-written by Bill and a reporter called Wills Robinson. Bill, the life during deployment seemed like it was a lot of downtime interspersed with absolute chaos, but that's one other thing that kind of made me smile. And part of that, tell us about your $11 million chair.
So, in Helmand Province, you know, that's, Afghanistan is one of the chief producers of heroin in the world, and they get a lot of the opium poppy grown in Helmand Province. The thing is, when we went for the Battle of Garmzer and we went for the Battle of Marja, we're not focused on burning down these poppy fields and stuff like that because, you know, that's the farmer's livelihood. That's the only way they're making cash. You know, we're trying to teach them, you know, hey, grow corn, grow this, that, you know, but up until then, all they've known is opium poppies. And when we assaulted Garmzer, we came through there pretty quick, and they didn't have all the time in the world to get all their stuff out. One of the compounds that we took over shortly after hitting that city, we posted up. We were in there a couple of days, and I found a nice little chair. Well, it was a bunch of, like, liquid sandbags, but threw a couple blankets over it, turned it into a nice, comfy little recliner for me. And we're just sitting there on post, watching out, looking out into the city one day, and the police advisor for our battalion comes by, and he's looking through the compound, and I show him my chair, and he just starts laughing. He's like, man, that's probably an $11 million, $12 million chair back home. I'm like, what the heck are you talking about, dude? And he pulls aside the blanket and opens up one of the bags. It's raw processed, or not raw, it's processed heroin. Just pounds upon pounds of it. I thought it'd make it a great liquid chair.
Yeah, well, you're glad you didn't get any of that leak through your skin. One of those other downtimes, coming back to the shot, Bill, one of those other downtimes, you were in the middle of, I'll just call it a field laundromat. This is, you were doing precisely what that salty old Marine recruiter warned you about. You know, your socks are going to be so crusty they'll stand up on their own, and you know, bring an extra pair of skivvies. So you're in that sort of downtime there doing your laundry. And you heard, you talk about how a lot of the Taliban, they, you know, kind of hold their weapon above their head and just sort of spray and pray. But one shot came in, and that struck you as very different. Why don't you take the story from there?
Yeah, because, you know, just like you said, a lot of the Taliban marksmanship has, it's got something to be desired. A lot of times they're engaging us at anywhere from 400 to 600 yards, which is perfectly fine with us because an AK isn't accurate past 300, whereas an M4 M16 goes out to 550. Well, we had got word that there was a marksman had moved into the area. Our intel section had intercepted that over the radio. So we were kind of keeping an eye out for that. And we heard one round crack above the compound, and that was it. And that alone is kind of suspect because, you know, normally when you're getting lit up by the Taliban, it's, you know, just a bunch of guys shooting on bursts, you know, praying they're going to hit you. But one shot, you know, that's kind of cause for concern. And I had just gotten off a SOG, you know, Sergeant of the Guard, but went over there to check on my guy regardless. And as soon as I went over there, I noticed off of the side, Gorn was sitting there fiddling around with his camera. But as I'm looking around, checking my guy, I see a curtain move in a compound, yeah, probably 7,500 yards away. You know, just it kind of shifted out of the way from a window. And the movement definitely dropped my attention. So I draw down on the window, and I'm just waiting for somebody to poke their head out. And as soon as that happens, just the world went dark. And apparently, the sniper was in a completely different position. I was aiming at somebody else. And I don't remember a thing from there. Just waking up on a stretcher, waiting for a Kazakh bird to come in. But, yeah, it was interesting how it happened.
So these mud walls that you were taking cover behind, would they normally deflect or stop a rifle round?
Oh yeah, without a doubt. Like, these mud walls are the bane of our existence. 50 cal rounds, anti-tank missiles, or I should say rockets, they'll deflect all of them. I've seen them take 25 millimeter AP or armored piercing rounds. You know, they'll just suck up the damage. It's insane.
And in this case, as best you can tell, it looks like the round maybe hit just below the lip of the berm and exploded into your face.
Yeah, that's what the way the Colton explained to me, the doc that treated me, looked like the round skipped up along with a bunch of rocks and stuff like that, and that's what knocked me out. And, yeah, I was probably out like 4 or 5 minutes.
So they're carrying you to the CASAVAC helicopter, and you convince them that you're okay. You want to go back to your men and continue the fight. And you look over at Gorham, and Gorham is just laughing his head off. Not at you, though.
Yep. I'm sitting down with the doc. Doc's looking over me. You know, I'm chewing on some Tylenol, and Gorham comes over with this big old grin on his face, and. Sergeant B, you would not believe what happened. I was like, what's up, man? He's like, I got it on picture. But no kidding. And he pulled it out, and he showed it to me. He explained to me that when he took the picture, he actually didn't mean to take it the way he did. He was testing out some new lens, and he'd actually accidentally set it on sequence shot, which just happened to catch the entire clip. And, I told him, I was like, man, that's amazing. He's like, yes, this picture only happened one time before, and that guy died. Like, oh, well, sweet. Glad I made it through. And I was like, dude, I gotta tell you though, if you ever win a Pulitzer or something like that, I better get some recognition for it. And he starts laughing, you know, I am Serbian. They will never give it to me.
Well, I tell you, the other thing about modern combat is, those sorts of images spread around the globe like wildfire, and before you could even blink another eye, this is on news networks and magazines and going all over the world. And unfortunately, your wife Bobby saw these images before you were able to reach her.
Yes. Yes. The next day, I got called over the radio because Marine Corps Public Affairs wanted to know if it was okay if they released my name and all that kind of stuff. And I told them that was fine under one condition. You know, I had to talk to my wife before anything. And the way we worked, it wasn't like we lived in one of those FOBs where you have internet and phone and all that kind of stuff. We had one phone for the entire company that you would get 15 minutes on, a 15-minute call once a week kind of thing. And, so they brought the phone down to my compound so I'd give her a call and let her know. But as soon as she picked up that phone, she was not a happy camper. Like, she was excited to hear from me, of course, but she was 7 months pregnant at the time, and that put a little bit of undue stress on her, let's put it that way.
Well,
she made me promise, you know, I don't care if I'm going to the bathroom, if I'm trying to sleep, it doesn't matter. You know, I got to wear my full gear the entire time.
Well, that's so folks need to understand that you rushed out there without your body armor or your helmet, and so this could have been a very, very bad scene. And honestly, folks, when you see these pictures, it's pretty amazing. It's so pretty amazing that you walked away from that. Bill, unfortunately, that wasn't your first or last traumatic brain injury. There was another situation with some IEDs embedded in a house where you and your fellow Marines were taking cover. Two of them were killed, and really it was that last IED that gave you the third brain injury that, for all practical purposes, put you out of commission, right?
Yeah. The that Mars deployment was a pretty rough one. We had a lot of casualties in our company, in our battalion. We had some in our platoon as well. And towards the end of the deployment, I want to say we only had 6, maybe 7 days left before we were going back to start a transition back to the States. and the advanced unit from 2-6, who was taking over for us, 2nd Battalion, 6th Marines, they came out, and our job was to show them the area, you know, not take them into, you know, Indian country, any of those really sketchy places, but just enough to show them where the Taliban like to hang out, those kind of things. And, yeah, I took my squad out on patrol along with two 2-6 squad leaders, and we occupied a compound that we'd only been in once the entire deployment. So we hung out there so I could show them the area, and we probably weren't there 15, 20 minutes, and my designated marksman for my squad called me over to give him a hand because his rifle had gotten jammed. And I was a little annoyed at him because that's something that should have been able to be handled. But as soon as I walked over by him and took a knee, like, that whole building blew. And it turns out they had a bunch of IEDs embedded in the walls instead of the ground, including right where those 2-6 guys were that I was at, like, a couple seconds prior. And half my squad got casualty'd. Both those sergeants were killed instantly. And, yeah, that messed me up for a while.
Bill, when we come back, I want to talk more about the rest of your journey, because as a civilian, again, reading your book and reading more a little bit about you, it makes me shake my head and, frankly, pound my fist, because it makes me angry about the way you were treated initially and what it took to try and turn things around. And there's a fellow by the name of Wills Robinson who was a big part of that. So I want to talk more about that when we come back. Folks, please visit SergeantBillB.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Marine Bill B. Bill was the subject, I'll say, of a series of just really compelling photographs shot in the Helmand province of Afghanistan, where he narrowly escaped death. But it really, I don't want to say that started him down a path, but I would say let's say it started him on a path that's going to turn out well and turn out good for recovery. Bill, you're back stateside. You're being, and I want to preface this, and maybe you'd agree with me. We had Paula Padain on, who was a whistleblower, the Navy veteran who was a whistleblower on the VA scandal and got the balls rolling there. The doctors and nurses, some of whom I know personally, they take good care of our military members. That's not the problem. But let's just say the administration leaves a little bit to be desired. Would you echo that sentiment, Bill?
Yeah, wholeheartedly.
So you're literally, you've got three traumatic brain injuries. People are telling you, well, you just saw your psychiatrist last year. Why do you need to see him again? And they've got you on a cocktail, Bill. As I understand it, at some point you were up to taking up to 18 pills a day, and you would just sit there at your kitchen table and just sort of line them up and start popping them down. And that was not working very well, was it?
Yeah, that was an issue. That wasn't the initial issue with the VA, though. My first problem was even being seen in the first place. Because when I first got out, you know, I did what I'm supposed to do. I filed the application form and waited for months for them to call me back to get me enrolled in VA healthcare. And, I mean, it took forever just to get that first step done, probably 3 months at least.
Before you saw anyone?
Yeah, before they even got me into the for my first evaluation. When they did, you know, I sit down, we address my issues. They say, okay, you're gonna need a general practitioner, you're gonna need a psychiatrist, a psychologist, all this kind of stuff, and we'll get those assigned to you. And you wait and wait. And I think it was another 2, maybe 3 months before I just, you know, I just got too frustrated with it. And that's when I had actually started talking to Wills.
Well, in talking to Wills, he said, I mean, you had, just because these compelling photographs that had gone worldwide, he was not the first person who had approached you about doing a follow-up story But as I understand it from him, his editor showed him these photos and said, hey, why don't you find this guy and check in with him and see how he's doing? But at that point, you had just about had enough. And finally, you thought, you know, maybe this is bigger than Bill. And maybe if I can get my story told in a broader way, I can start helping other folks that are going through what I'm going through with the VA.
Exactly. I had been approached before, but, you know, I just had this policy of I'm not going to talk to anything or anyone about anything. But my job at the time was working for the VA, teaching transitioning service members how to use their benefits and how awesome the VA is supposed to be. And they sucked. And it was blowing my mind because, you know, a month couldn't go by where you weren't seeing an article like, you know, the man dying, and I think it was the Phoenix VA dying in the car, was left there for hours before anyone noticed. You know, you got guys setting themselves on fire outside of VAs just to get somebody to pay attention to them. And, yeah, at that point I was like, you know, somebody, it's stuff needs to be said. And I had actually received a letter from Wills. That's kind of what made me pay attention to it, was he actually wrote a handwritten letter. And I sat on that for a couple months because I was like, you know, I don't know if I want to talk to any reporters about anything. And
the rest, they say, is history.
Yeah. When the VA said, you know, hey, you're going to have to pay for this treatment yourself, it was something that was – it was directly related to one of my injuries. I was like, you know what? That's it. And I called Wills up and I'm like, look, man, I'll talk to you about everything. Any questions you got answered or any questions you've got, I will answer freely. And, you know, I went full bore. I told him every single issue I saw with the VA, everything I saw with DOD, and that's about it.
Now, Bill, that eventually has evolved into this book, The Shot. How... this is literally just released, and folks, you can find out more, visit SergeantBillB.com. How do you feel? I know it's kind of early in the process, but how do you feel about having your story exposed, warts and all?
That was kind of a big thing between me and the wife, because, you know, do we glaze over, you know, some of this stuff? Do we portray the most positive light, you know, we can, because there's definitely been some dark spots out there. And it was like, no, you know, if people want to understand actually what happened, then I'm going to be honest about what happened.
And I, in a previous interview, Bill, I heard you say, and this is the, well, only just one of a bunch of tragedies in this story and the story of other men and women in the military and the VA, is, you know, it shouldn't have to take an article in the Daily Mail and several articles after that to get someone to pay attention. Because the minute that article was published, all of a sudden you got VA administrators wanting to bend over backwards saying, hey, how can we help you, Bill?
Literally the next day, after Wills' article had released, I got a call saying, hey, you know, this is so-and-so with the VA. I've been directed to call you. Just want to let you know that those bills that we sent you, that was in there. We're gonna handle those, and we're also going to be assigning your mental health professional soon. And that's exactly what I told them. You know, it shouldn't take a news article for someone to get help for something they rated in the first place.
Right, right. You earned it. It's, well, That's a whole nother show, Bill, but I just got to say, I was browsing your Facebook page, and I got to read a quote here for you, and this comes from Bobby, and she says, never in a million years would I think the annoying dude who kept coming into my work in uniform thinking that would impress me, kind of did, I guess, LOL, for any reason or excuse he made up just to talk to me, would later be a published author. Never did I think all of our trauma and tribulations would go on to help others. I truly think that was and will continue to be his driving force.
Yeah, basically that is the main goal with this book, because, you know, in the infantry community, especially when I was in my earlier times, the stigma was you do not talk to mental health. If you went to the BAS and you talked to a shrink or a wizard or whatever you wanted to call them, then that's okay. That's your right. But you weren't fit to lead Marines because mentally you weren't tough enough. And I bought that hook, line, and sinker. I preached that, you know. And then I started to realize, especially after my last injury, that, you know, you can't do this by yourself. And like it or not, you know, you need to break down and ask for help at some point. I mean, the VA, the civilian communities, all these charitable organizations, they will move heaven and earth itself to get you the help that you need. But you've got to be willing to break down and ask for it. And that's one of what I think one of the big reasons we have such a high rate of veteran suicides is, you know, especially at the time, it was, you know, guys being scared to break down and ask for help.
And Bill, I got to tell you, we're just about out of time, but if folks go to SergeantBillB.com, I know there's some links up there as well where folks can find help. And, you know, I try and preach, but it's not as important coming to from me as it is from someone like you who's been there, done that, got the T-shirt.
Yeah, and I mean, it blows my mind because you would see guys get on Facebook and I'm going to do 22 push-ups a day to raise veteran awareness of suicide. It's like, honestly, that's not doing anything. You know, if you want to help with the issue of veteran suicide, then it's more along the lines of picking up the phone and calling your boys, calling your girls, checking on them.
Attaboy. Okay, Bill, thank you so much for spending your time with us. Ladies and gentlemen, until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 300 episodes of this program via AmericanWarriorRadio.com or the most recent episodes via your favorite podcast app.